Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of the call. If you'd like to ask a question during that time, please press star followed by number one. Today's conference is being recorded. Any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'd like to turn over the conference to Melissa Grasso.
Great. Thank you so much, Angela, and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us as we continue our special conference call series. Today's topic is employment issues related to teleworking. I'm really pleased to have Matt McLavy with us. He's a partner with the law firm Robinson & Cole. Encourage you to take a look at Matthew's bio. He has an extensive bio. I'll give a little bit of a brief introduction. As I said, Matt is a partner with the law firm of Robinson & Cole. He has more than three decades of experience as a labor, employment, and civil rights attorney, and he served as a litigator, counselor, and contract negotiator throughout his career. He's also a member of Robinson & Cole's Labor, Employment, Benefits, and Immigration group. Just a couple quick housekeeping notes. We will be recording the call and sending out the record link. All of the participants' lines are muted, but we will have a Q&A session. So if you'd like to ask a question, you can just hit star one, and you'll be put into the queue. So with that, I'll turn things over to Matt. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Melissa, for that introduction. I really appreciate it. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for attending this conference call. As Melissa said, I'm a partner with Robinson & Cole, and I focus my practice in the New York City and Stamford, Connecticut offices, what we call the New York metro sector. My practice for over 30 years has focused on employment, labor, and civil rights litigation and law. I am I'm also a member of the firm's coronavirus response team. We're putting out a lot of materials. We're going to try to cover a lot today, but there's a lot of materials, and you can access them all at our website. It's a really easy website. It's rc.com. I'm going to try to get to all of your questions today if I can, but you're free to reach out to me after this conference, either through the website or through my email. Send me a direct email is fine. M. McLave, that's M-M-I-K-L-A-V-E at rc.com. During this conference today, I'm going to be talking about the coronavirus or COVID-19 outbreak. When I use those two terms, I mean the same thing. I know technically they're different, but I'm not a doctor and I don't play one on television, so I'm not going to try to get into any medical science. So we live in a time that has almost become a cliche. We say that it's unprecedented. I hear that a lot. I'm going to give you a little bit of a pushback on that. I would say we are in unusual times. We're in not normal times. We're outside of the ordinary course of business. But I think it's a mistake to say they're unprecedented. We have had serious disruptions to our society before and great economic challenges. In our own lifetimes, we have witnessed the September 11 terror attacks and the aftermath and the Great Recession. There have been fires in California. There have been floods. There have been hurricanes. We have gone through this farther back in our history. There have been times of great war and great depression. I kind of have this perception because, as it happens, Robinson & Cole will be celebrating our 175th anniversary this year. And all year long, we have been thinking about the last 175 years of our practice and how we have changed with the times. So you will hear a little bit about that in my remarks, working to remember the lessons from our past so we can anticipate the challenges to come. In our presentation today, we're going to be talking about telework generally. And more specifically, I'm going to address some wage and hour issues that come up, some ADA discrimination and Title VII issues, workplace safety concerns, sick leave and issues of isolation, data security, and job reductions. I'm not promising that I have all of the answers to all of these questions. What I can tell you is I read a lot, and I use the Internet with great effect. And what I've seen on the Internet, some of it is really, really good stuff, but some of it is not. So you have to be careful about whose, quote, advice you are taking. There is some advice that I've seen that I just don't agree with. So be careful. There's a great commercial going on right now. I don't know if you've seen this. We've all watched way too much television, where all this company's data was destroyed after they downloaded a free antivirus software. So be careful what you're relying upon. Make sure you get good legal counsel. We're doing our best to try to help folks figure out what to do now and in the months ahead. Now, one of the lessons I've learned as a trial attorney throughout my experience is that your decisions today will be looked at through the perfect clarity, the 2020 vision of hindsight. Your decisions will be judged 6 months from now, 9 months from now, or 36 months from now, based on how things actually turned out, not how they might have turned out. So you'll be judged in part based on circumstances. You don't know what the world is going to be like in 36 months. So your decisions will be judged in that light. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. We recommend our clients document the decisions they make contemporaneously and include the rationale for those decisions. And I'm going to be talking a lot and stressing a lot the need for documentation. So first, let's talk about telework generally. We use the term telework, but what we're really talking about is working remotely. And when we use that term telework, we're thinking about it in terms of an office work, clerical work. Folks like me and my firm, we're attorneys, we're able to work remotely. Our legal assistants are able to work remotely. But I would suggest that you should think of telework in a broader context. Think of it as working from your home, whether that's an office business or a cottage business. We call cottage businesses because they started in the cottages of the workers in the countryside. They weren't centralized. There was a whole system of work before companies brought together massive amounts of people to work in central locations. Estee, for example, is a great company that has thousands of remote workers. They don't work in any particular place. And I think we need to think about that and think about it in the context of whether we're doing parts assembly or manufacturing or medical supplies or anything else. I read an article on Twitter just the other day about a company that was asking its workers who were at home, those who had sewing machines and skills, to make medical masks that would be donated to hospital workers. I thought it was a very creative way of talking about home work, working from home, or telework. The first issue when we talk about telework is who gets to work from home? If your business is like mine, we're able to send almost everyone home. But some businesses are essential under state and local mandates and have to stay in business. Some businesses can provide essential services remotely and still have working employees working from home, but some can't. Some have to decide we need to have some employees come to work. How you make those decisions, you can't always send everyone home. You have to have some folks at the office. But if you're an essential business, you have to think about, well, is every employee in my location an essential business? Do I get to pick and choose? And you have to consider the legal, human resources, and public relations impact of all of those decisions. Obviously, decisions about who comes to work and who stays home should not be based on race, gender, or any other protected characteristics. That's pretty standard stuff. But what happens when your management team all works remotely, but your shop workers don't? Is there a potential for that to be misconceived or misperceived as a discrimination issue? If part of the shop goes home and part of it goes to work, who do you decide which group goes where? Do you try to make decisions, and we've had discussions with some of our clients about this, you try to make decisions based upon who's more vulnerable than other people, who's more at risk, and does that translate into sending men and women over the age of 60 home and letting other people stay at work who are younger than that? Let me suggest that that may be problematic at best. No matter what your remote working arrangement is, I think it's really important that it be documented, that you make sure there's a written policy, that the policy is distributed to the employees who are working remotely and those that are home. We're going to talk about a lot of these issues as we talk about some of the other things in here. I'll be constantly talking about a written policy. I think it's important that you document that this is a temporary policy, not a permanent policy. I think you need to consider who pays for the computer equipment? Who pays for the phone lines? Who pays for the cell phones, the internet, the printers, the paper, and the ink? Is that an expense you're expecting the employees to pick up, or is that an expense that you're going to cover and reimburse them for? When we talk about working remotely, working from home, whose home are we talking about? Are we talking about someone working from their home that's a local home, or are we talking about people who have second homes? Maybe they're in Florida. Maybe they're in the mountains. Maybe they're somebody else. And do you want to restrict their ability to go to remote locations or not? Or do you care? Those are issues that you should take into account whenever you're thinking about your remote work policy. Let's talk about some wage and hour issues that you're going to come into. When you have remote workers, you still have to make sure that you're complying with federal and state wage and hour laws. And there are a couple of tricky issues. First of all, your non-exempt employees, these are employees that have to be paid by the hour. There are some that are salaried non-exempt employees. They get the same salary every week, and you have some alternate plans for them. I don't want to get into those weeds here for this call. So let's just consider the non-exempt employees are hourly workers. Obviously, you have to pay them minimum wage and overtime. Under federal law, when they work more than 40 hours a week, you have to make sure they're paid time and a half. Some states have daily overtime requirements, California for one. Some states have show-up requirements. In New York, if you show up, you're guaranteed a certain number of hours of pay, no matter how many hours you work. These laws are still going to apply to a home-based worker, so you've got to make sure you're keeping in track of that. And you have to make sure you're maintaining any spread of hours claims. You have to make sure you're keeping contemporaneously time records of employees. Generally, under federal law, you have to keep track of their starting time, their ending time, their breaks of over 15 minutes, the number of hours they work per day, the number of hours they work per week, and the number of hours of overtime. Those have to be contemporaneous records. And you're going to have to make a decision in your remote work policy how you're going to keep track of that and how you're going to verify that. Are you going to be verifying the working hours of employees or not? And that works in one of two ways. Are people really putting in the time they're claiming to work and you're compensating them appropriately? Or are they putting in more time than they're actually charging you for? Are you taking advantage of that? You may have an employee who, in normal circumstances, may not be the most productive employee in the office, and now you've sent them home and you're expecting them to work. Well, now this person may think, oh, this is my opportunity to show that I'm hyper productive. So I'm going to work 12 hours a day, but I'm only going to put it down for 8 hours because I want to show them what a good employee I am. You've got to be able to verify that conduct. You have to be able to verify that because you owe that person based on the number of hours they work, not the number of hours they claim to work. So you should think about some system for that. Exempt employees, as we know, they're paid on a salary basis, and home work or telework can present some unique challenges for them. So let's just go through the basics, right? If you have an exempt employee, they have to perform exempt duties, either as a professional, exempt administrative, or exempt executive. They have to be paid on a salary basis, and they have to be paid a weekly salary more than a certain amount. Under federal law, that's $684 per week or $35,568 per year. State laws may be different. New York has a much higher salary than the $35,000 per year based on the county where the employee works. So they have to be paid on a salary basis, and that means they get the same salary every week regardless of the number of hours they work. So if they perform 15 minutes worth of work in that week, you have to pay them their full salary. If they perform 80 hours worth of work, you have to pay them their full salary. The salary is not subject to reduction because of the number of hours they work. There are a couple of exceptions to that. A week when they perform no work at all, their first week of work, their last week of work, a week when they're on FMLA leave, and a week when the employee either hasn't qualified for sick leave or other job leave, or they've exhausted their supply of sick leave or job leave, then you can not pay them in full day increments. Now, consider what happens to the salary basis test if you are one of the employers that's contemplating a shared work reduction. Shared work is a state unemployment compensation proceeding when you register with the state, what you're basically saying is we're either going to lay off 25% of our workforce, but in the alternative, we want to lay off everybody 25% of their hours. If you register with the state first, you will make those employees eligible for a 25% unemployment benefit. It's a way to help supplement their pay. So they get 75% of their normal pay for their work and 25% extra. I think shared work programs with respect to salaried employees form quite a contrast, become quite problematic for two reasons. Number one, in some cases, if you reduce their hours, you're going to reduce them before that below that $35,000 number or whatever your state law number is. But more importantly, if you're reducing their number of hours, their pay, based on the percentage of time they're working, there's a question as to whether you are actually paying them a salary basis anymore. And do you destroy the exemption not only for that employee, but for all employees in that same classification, that same class? I don't have an answer to that question. I've been trying to look at this for a long time. There aren't any cases that I've come up with that I've been able to locate on that. Some of the officials that I've talked to have basically said, that's a great question, wish we had an answer. But it's something to take into account. Another question about the exempt status of employees that could be challenged by telework assignments deals with whether they are doing exempt duties. Now, the federal law states, Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, says that the exempt duties have to be the primary duty of the employee. But in some cases, particularly when the employee is no longer at work, let's say they're the shop foreman or they're the lead foreman or they have their primary duty of supervision and they're not supervising people the same way that they did before, are they taking on non-exempt duties? A temporary change in the duties of the employee will not destroy the exemption. But other circumstances, you could see that temporary change over time becomes permanent. And then you have to ask the question whether they're performing exempt duties anymore. There are some state laws that require the exempt duties not only be the primary duty, but be the majority of the employee's time. So sending them home and having them do other duties from home may impact on that policy, may impact on that exemption. And as I just to reiterate again, when their weekly salary, when that falls below the minimum threshold required by federal or state law, you undermine the salary basis exception. All right. Let's talk about a little workplace safety issue. Just because a person is working from home does not mean they are not covered by OSHA workplace safety standards or by workers' compensation policies. You should check your workers' compensation policy to make sure it covers employees that work from home. That is really important. Make sure you do that before you send folks home. If you have workers that are teleworking, working remotely, you still have a duty to provide a safe workplace for the employee, and this can get a little complicated. Now, you don't have an obligation to provide a safe home for the employee, but a safe workplace. When we think about this concept, at least with respect to OSHA, we differentiate between the home office and a home manufacturing or assembly facility. If the person is working from a home office, doing clerical or professional duties like the lawyer, the accountant, the graphic designer, then OSHA takes the position they will not inspect that workplace to ensure that it's safe. And if there is an issue, the employer will not be liable for that. If an employee files a complaint, the person filing the complaint will be advised of OSHA's policy not to conduct inspections and not to hold the employer liable. And if requested, OSHA will contact the employer and advise the employer that there has been a complaint made about that home-based business or home-based office, but no action is going to be taken. A home manufacturing or assembly facility is completely different. OSHA will inspect those facilities if a complaint is made. And if there are hazards as a result of that inspection that are identified, the employer will be held liable. We think about this in the context of, give you an example. a garage has to close because of the social distancing requirements, but the mechanic goes home and is going to work on cars in his garage. The mechanic is going to be assembling, or fixing automobiles with parts, et cetera, and tools. You've got to make sure that the equipment is safe. You have to make sure the materials provided by the employer meet OSHA safety standards. You can't jack up the car using a couple of oil cans kind of leaning against something. You have to make sure that the equipment is there where that employee can perform the duties successfully and safely. And if you don't engage in that kind of analysis, you're going to have some issues. You're also going to be responsible if there are known hazards, the employer knew or should have known of those hazards and failed to take responsibility of it. So think about, from an OSHA standpoint, think about the type of job the employee is doing and when they're being sent home to work from home. What do you need to know? And I would suggest that all of this should be addressed in your policies for remote working. With respect to workers' compensation, if an employee is injured at home in the course and scope of their employment, in the course of performing their duties and the scope of their employment, that will be a reportable workers' compensation claim and a reportable workers' compensation injury. The example I use, if the clerical worker is setting up their home computer and the computer falls off the desk and it hits their foot and breaks their foot, that's a workers' compensation injury. If it's unrelated to work, if the employee is going to get a cup of coffee and trips over the dog or falls down the stairs, that's not a compensable injury. So you need to take that into account. And again, I would recommend that you make sure that your policy makes clear, if there is an injury, how they handle it, how it's reported, how you report it either to OSHA or to workers' compensation. Okay. Next, I want to talk about some issues with respect to the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, and Title VII. These are federal statutes preventing discrimination, and I think the teleworking creates some issues for us. We get a lot of questions from clients, well-intentioned people who want to keep touch with their employees. They want to know what's going on. We have a lot of issues with workforce that's isolated or not working in the office, and we get lots of those questions. So some clients wanted, or some employers will want to reach out, proactively contact employees to ask how they're doing. How are you feeling? Have you been ill? You have to be careful because, remember, there are limitations on what kinds of medical questions and medical tests that you can ask employees. So you need to be careful about that. There is some guidance from the ADA under pandemics that have been in the past where the EEOC has taken the position. It's all right to have employees have their temperatures taken. It's okay to make these kind of inquiries. Just because it's okay, the question I would have is, should you be doing that? Is that something you really want to go down? Particularly once the coronavirus became community-based, do those questions really make as much sense now as they did then when this initially started, where we had lots of screening questions, vendors were being screened, employees were being screened, and we had lots of policies in place? Is that really matter at this point in time, given where we are? And I think, you want to think about how you're going to document what's being done. And are you keeping track of those responses from employees? And again, I think there's a lot of difference of opinion on this. I have my own view. I know a lot of attorneys at my firm have a different view on that. But if you are going to go around calling up people and asking questions of them, are you keeping track of what their answers are? And even if you're not keeping track of what their answers are they thinking that you're keeping track of their answers? And this is one of those 2020 hindsights. We can see, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, 36 months from now, after the employers had to make decisions based on economic circumstances, potentially completely unrelated to the coronavirus issue, they're making decisions. Is the employer thinking, I remember, 12 months ago, they called me up, asked me how I was feeling, and I told them I was feeling depressed. Are they making a decision based on the fact that they think I'm a depressed person and I'm going to be making more access of health care or other issues like that? So I think you have to be careful about that. whatever your decisions are, I would recommend that you document what those decisions are, even if the decision is we're going to ask these questions, but we're not going to record the answers. I think that's something you need to document, and you need to explain why. Just remember, hindsight is 20/20. I would also stress that just because the Americans with Disability Act and the EEOC has taken a position that these medical inquiries in time of pandemic, these tests, these healthcare checks, may be acceptable, that doesn't mean your state or your city law will hold them to be acceptable. In New York State, New York City, we have two completely different statutes with respect to disability discrimination. The rules under those statutes may be very different. We're going to be litigating this for a long time. I think that the other issue, the discrimination issue, which telework presents to us, deals with issues of whether or not showing up to work is an essential job function. This is something that we often get when you have an employee who is unable to physically get to work because of a medical condition or because of a covered disability. Usually, there have been many of these cases where an employee will say, well, showing up is not required. I can do this work from home. Up until now, virtually every case which has looked at this issue has held that showing up, regular attendance, is a requirement of the job. But now that everyone is working from home, and we're accommodating that kind of conduct on a global basis, we have to ask the question of whether or not home-based work is a reasonable accommodation or not. And I don't know what the answer to that question is. I expect we're going to have to address it in the weeks and months to come. How do you say to a person who has been working from home for 2 or 3 months and nothing bad happened, the employer continued to do business, but now suddenly when that employee can't report to work after everything goes back to normal because of a medical condition, we're not going to let them work from home anymore. I don't know if it's that sudden. I don't know if it's that clear. And what about the employee who may have a pregnancy-related medical condition so they can't come into the office? They have to work from home. Once again, I think that's a very tough question. Remember, Title VII has accommodations for workplace for pregnancy and complications from pregnancy. So my considered wisdom is make sure you have a written policy. I may have said that 40 times already. All right. I'd like to next touch upon some data privacy and security issues. I think data privacy and security of the workplace, these are issues that we're going to really be having to deal with, and it comes up, and there are six different aspects of this. The first one I want to talk about is hacking, right? Your data security system is no more or less strong than your weakest link. Some of you may remember that TV show that was on a long time ago. I can't remember. It was probably called Weakest Link, where the woman, when she threw everybody off the show, would say, "You are the weakest link." Now you've got 200, 300 people working remotely using computers from home. Your network is no more safe than the least protected computer in that link. The weakest link may be carried over. Let's think about this in a couple of ways. Have you provided the computer equipment to all of your professionals, or do you want them to use their own computer equipment in order to save on costs? And what kind of firewall or other protections are built into that personal workspace, that personal computer? Do you have a VPN with firewalls set up so people can sign in securely? Or are you using the internet in order to do that? We've seen a big uptick in hacking, phishing emails, malware, as a result of this event that we're experiencing. You should have a data privacy and security policy in place. You should have taken into account what you're going to do in order to protect your computer network, because that may be, in many cases, your most valuable piece of intellectual property. Another aspect of data security and privacy deals with those employers that protect their IP through the use of non-compete, non-solicitation, and confidentiality agreements. I do a lot of litigation in the what I call the post-employment restriction phase, non-competes, non-solicitations, confidentiality. One of the things that is pretty well universal is that in order to have a valid non-compete, non-solicitation, you have to establish that you have a protectable interest, that you've taken reasonable steps to protect that interest other than simply having a non-compete, and that you've done the things that are necessary for blocking and tackling. Well, now with so many people working from home, you have a tremendous amount of material that's outside of your control, your intellectual property that's in homes across potentially the country and maybe even in other countries. That could be a real loophole in you trying to enforce a post-employment restriction down the road. You need to think about that as part of your policy and what you're going to do to make sure that you can still show that that's a valid non-compete or non-solicitation, even though all this information is spread out all over the place. I think that's a big weakness. What are you doing about documents that are printed off at home? So we all have a lot of confidential information. I know I have client information. We have to print it out because I'm still a paper guy. I can't do everything online. I still need to print stuff out and underline it and highlight it and all that kind of stuff. What do you do with that paper when it's done? You should not be throwing it in the trash. What you should be doing is having it shredded, either having it shredded at home or instructing the employee to put it in a bag, bring it back to the office whenever we're going to have the office back open again, and using those shredders in the office to make sure that confidential material is not distributed out all over the place. You need to take those proactive steps to make sure at least you have a policy. I also think there's a big need to preserve work product, particularly in those places where the value of your company is in your intellectual property, in your ideas, in your work product. You need to make sure that you get all that stuff back, that if people have it on their personal computers, that there's a way of getting that back into the database of the employer and removed from those personal computers at the end of whenever this is going to end, but whenever it ends, you get it back. So that's going to be important. I have mentioned already several times, document your decisions. Now, this may be easy for the HR team and the senior managers, but remember, you're going to have a group of supervisors potentially that are working from home. Are they still supervising people? In many cases, they're going to be supervising people remotely. And I talked about before about the ADA. I talked about the health-related inquiries. Well, just because you have a policy that says we're not making these health-related inquiries, have you communicated that policy to the first-level or second-level supervisors? Some of them have grown up with their friends who are on the assembly line or they're in the office. They may be one step removed from the rank-and-file worker. They may completely innocently be making medically related inquiries and you don't know about it. So you have to make sure that you're documenting your decisions, you're documenting your guidelines, you're coordinating with them. And this is a little bit of a pet peeve of mine. I believe that many companies don't have really good training programs for their supervisors. What do I mean? Well, what tends to happen is that we take somebody that was that's a really good rank-and-file worker. Maybe they're working on the assembly line, and they're the best widget maker on that assembly line. And we take and we say, great, now I'm going to make you the widget line supervisor without giving them any training. That person may think that means I'm supposed to be a super widget maker, and I don't think that's really what we want. What I think we want is that supervisor to inspire the other line individuals to be super widget makers, passing that knowledge on, not doing more of it themselves, but helping those below them become super decision makers, super widget makers. And I think that requires some training. So this is a great time while we're making sure that we're documenting decisions, while we're making sure our first and second line managers that are working remotely are taking the appropriate steps to give them training that reinforces all of the things that we're talking about. And finally, let me mention on this topic a little bit about physical security. We have all of this computer equipment. We have all of these remote working assignments. We may have tools. We may have materials going to people's homes. We have to keep track of it. We have to make sure that it is secure against loss and protection. we should be taking steps to make sure that at least with our electronic data, it's password protected, it has appropriate firewalls and things along those lines. If this kind of information is on home-based computers, personal computers, which I do not recommend, I think we have to be extra vigilant on this sort of thing. Finally, let me talk a little bit about sick leave, and this goes back to a wage and hour issue as well. So remember that under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, which was passed last week, we have two new federal rights to paid leave. We have emergency paid FMLA leave, and we have paid sick leave. New York adopted its own paid sick leave provision as well, became effective immediately. The coronavirus, Families First Coronavirus Response Act becomes effective on April 1st. It was scheduled to become effective on April 2nd, but the Department of Labor announced yesterday that it was going to be effective on April 1st. So your employees may be working from home, may be eligible for these leaves. You have a responsibility to make sure that you give them notice of their leaves. They're published, the Department of Labor came out with two notices yesterday that we will be circulating, and they're pretty widely circulated now. You've got to make sure that your employees get those notices, and there's some kind of process by which those are rolled out to the employees and the employees acknowledge receipt. But then if they are eligible for the leaves, you're going to have to make sure that you're tracking that leave usage. You're going to have to make sure that employees know to report. This kind of goes back from your work from home policy. Even if it's a temporary work from home policy, you got to make sure that you're doing that stuff. I think that this is obviously a very fluid situation. The CARE Act, the $2.3 trillion federal stimulus bill that was passed by the Senate yesterday, contains amendments to the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. We're going to be looking at that in the next few days. We'll probably take a look at that, obviously. Let me throw out for you another consideration. There are other federal and state leave laws that were already on the books, paid family leave in many states, paid sick leave in some cities, Family and Medical Leave Act. Let me suggest to you that a diagnosis of COVID-19 is likely going to be a serious medical condition. Even a suspicion of a diagnosis of COVID-19 likely will be a serious medical condition, which will qualify folks for leave under the Family and Medical Leave Act, either to care for themselves or to care for a family member. So you've got all of this interplay of all these leave statutes. You're still responsible for making sure that you keep track of all of those things and making sure that you comply with your statutory requirements. That's a big handful of stuff you need to do. So I've gone through kind of a breathless summary of some of the issues that we're seeing. I apologize. It was pretty quick. But before we open up to questions, I wanted to leave you with a couple of further thoughts, if I can. First, no one knows what will happen tomorrow, let alone next week. The pace of change is faster than anything I have ever seen, and the pace taxes us physically, emotionally, and mentally. Working from home is hard. Some of your employees are really under a lot of stress, and we need to take that into account. This hopefully will be a temporary measure. Second, while you and your business may not have gone through this precise event before, I think you can learn to address these challenges by following the challenges for your business and businesses like yours before. That's sort of this 175-year history that I've talked about. We haven't foreseen this precise circumstance, but we've seen big events, and we're all going to get through with it. We'll figure it out, maybe not as fast or as elegantly as some others do, but we'll go through this, and our workforce will be stronger and better able to meet the challenges in the years to come, and I truly believe that. So I guess we can open up for questions.
Thank you so much, Matthew. You really provided us with a host of super helpful information. Angela, could you remind companies on the call how they can ask a question?
Thank you. We will now begin a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name clearly. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment, please, while we wait for the first question.
And while we wait, I'll give a quick plug for our continued conference calls next week. On Tuesday, we have a call regarding working with your state and federal legislatures during this time. Wednesday's call will be about government-backed lending, and Thursday's call will be about IRS reporting and tax deadlines. Any questions in the queue, Angela?
No questions at this time.
So, Matthew, you've got time for some final thoughts if you'd like to summarize anything. I know you provided us, again, with a host of all helpful information, but if you'd like to have some final thoughts, we have time for that.
Well, I'd simply say to everybody, you know, we're all trying to figure this out as we go along. I do think we can learn from the histories of the past. I do think that, you know, there'll be a lot of discussions about what we should have done when we were making the decisions we were making now. And I think there may be a little bit of a second guessing when that happens. I think that if you document what you're doing, why you're doing it, you think about these issues in advance, you try to, you know, it's not to get out of work from home policy now, to make sure that it's a temporary policy and not a permanent situation, and to deal with it on a case-by-case basis. And I know, you know, we get calls from our clients every day about these very same challenges. And so I think we're just kind of all figuring it out together. That's my final thought.
Great. Again, thank you so much, Matthew. We really appreciate you lending us your expertise for the afternoon. Again, I highly encourage everyone on the call to visit the Robinson & Cole website. They have a host of great resources related to this crisis and business-related issues. And again, we will be sending out the recording. So thank you, everyone. Thank you again, Matthew, for joining us, and have a great afternoon.
Thank you all.
Thank you for your participation in today's conference. Please disconnect at this time.